Good morning, everyone. My name is Daniel Melvin. I'm a partner at McDermott Will & Emery, and my co-presenter is Tom Greeson from Reed Smith here in Virginia, and together we welcome you to this session on Medicare diagnostic testing that's going to cover a lot of different topics that are hot or tough topics. This sweeps in a wide range of issues, jam-packed agenda, so let's jump on it. Before we do that, if I could get a sense of how many of you out there consider yourselves to be kind of intermediate advanced in the area of Medicare diagnostic testing? And how many of you consider yourselves just absolute beginners? First introduction to the area, okay? How many of you are predominantly consider yourselves in the physician IDTF area of the diagnostic, that's where you work over, as opposed to institutional? And how many of you are more primarily institutional in your intro to diagnostics? Okay, that's very helpful for us to get a sense of the audience today. Just a couple of quick housekeeping matters. Please take a moment to fill out your evaluation at the end of the program. We value your feedback, as does the program committee. And you'll see in your materials you have a detailed outline. We work very hard on that outline every year to keep it updated. It's quite detailed. Unfortunately, a section got left out when I went to press, so we have an updated version that covers the physician supervision issue for HOPD diagnostics, hospital outpatient diagnostics. So if you would like the updated outline, it'll be posted on the website in a day or two, but also just leave us your business card. We'll just PDF you or email you the updated outline, as we can also do with our slides. Our slides will also be posted, but if you'd like a set of the slides, just leave us your business card. We split them up every year, and we'll shoot you out the slides as well. So with that, let's get going. We've got just a few items to cover here today. We're going to talk a bit about healthcare reform, the implications of reform for diagnostic testing, Medicare coverage of diagnostic testing, enrollment accreditation issues, billing, anti-markup, and just a little bit of an update on Stark Law issues. But before we jump in, just to make sure for you beginners out there, we're all talking about using nomenclature that you follow and we use uniformly. When we say diagnostic testing facility, we're referring to literally any diagnostic testing facility other than a clinical laboratory facility. Clinical laboratory law has developed separate and apart from the diagnostic testing area, so everything but the clinical laboratory. When we say HOPD diagnostic facility, it just means a hospital outpatient department diagnostic testing facility. When we say a diagnostic testing service, of course, we're referring to any diagnostic testing service except a clinical laboratory test. And when we refer to professional component or technical component of a diagnostic test, the professional components reference to the interpretation, the physician service component of a diagnostic test. The technical component is everything else. It's the technologists, it's the equipment, it's the facility. And when we make a reference to globally or bill globally, that's when you would bill for both the professional component and the technical component. So at least now we won't lose our beginners too early in the program.
All right. This is my turn to begin. Just a little bit more background about me. I come to this presentation from the perspective of an attorney that practices in this area extensively. My background is former counsel of the American College of Radiology. So in my practice, most of my clients are diagnostic radiology groups and diagnostic imaging facilities. So with that disclaimer, you'll hear that perspective in my presentation. Diagnostic testing services are very much, Diagnostic testing services are very much in the center of the healthcare reform discussion. Diagnostic testing is an area that has grown very rapidly, as shown by this slide. The CBO actually illustrated how diagnostic testing services have, the expenditures under the Medicare program have grown extensively for particularly advanced diagnostic imaging services. The CBO pointed out from 2000 to 2006, you can see that there was a 13% annual growth in Medicare Part B payments for diagnostic testing services and for advanced imaging services, MR, CT, PET. Those advanced imaging services, they grew at an even faster rate, 17% annually. So this area is one that actually would be targeted for trying to find savings to pay for, help the score for healthcare reform. The way that both CMS and the Congress have addressed this in the past year has been through the formula for the practice expense component of the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule Relative Value System. As you know, the RVS contains relative values for physician work, for practice expenses, for malpractice risk, and it's this practice expense component that has actually been subject of a great deal of discussion. Historically, CMS considered in terms of paying the practice expense component for diagnostic testing services, for imaging, for example, that the equipment was used 50% of the time, 25 hours per week. If that utilization formula was increased, say to 90% or 95%, this slide illustrates the fact that the per procedure practice expense that would be available for that given procedure would be decreased significantly. So you can see by this slide that that should the utilization factor be increased to 75%, for example, there'd be a $1.9 billion savings to the Medicare program over a 10-year period. If it was increased to 95%, that utilization formula, it'd be the savings were projected to be as much as $3 billion over that period of time. There's been a great deal of concern about this, obviously, and a lot of debate about what the impact would be, what would be the effect on the distribution of important diagnostic testing services, particularly in rural areas, if this was adopted. CMS did propose and did adopt an increase in the utilization factor for testing services, relying primarily on a new practice expense survey done by the AMA. And in the 2010 Medicare Physician Fee Schedule final rule, CMS adopted a 90% utilization formula for what they called expensive technology. They indicated it would relate to this increased utilization factor would relate to expensive technology valued at over $1 million per year, which CMS indicated in their preamble comments would be applied to MR and CT services. Now, this is a 90% utilization formula, but it's phased in over a 4-year period. It would not be fully implemented until 4 years from now if there were no further changes. Beginning this year, CMS, in paying for the practice expense component for MR and CT services beginning 2010, has relied on the 90% utilization formula for 25% of the utilization payment, the 25% of the practice expense, practice cost component. 75% still uses the old historical 50% utilization factor. So this year is 25-75. Next year would be 50-50, 75-25, and then fully implemented in 4 years if this was allowed to go unchanged. But the Congress has been obviously dealing with this same issue in their legislation to actually try to gain some savings out of health care reform. In the Senate bill that was actually adopted on Christmas Eve and then adopted by the House this past Sunday, the Senate bill increased the utilization rate over in a 4-year phased-in period, 65%, 70%, then 75% beginning in 2014. The 75% utilization factor would be fully implemented in 2014 under the Senate bill. It should be noted that this legislation, the Senate bill, applies to what are called advanced imaging services. That's a defined term in the Medicare Act, defined by MIPA. And advanced imaging services are MR, CT, PET, and nuclear medicine services. So this utilization rate adopted by the Senate applies to MR, CT, PET, and nuclear medicine services. And obviously in the Senate bill, if it's not modified by the House Reconciliation Act, this will be the utilization rate that will be applied to those procedures. Both the Senate bill and the House bill also contain another cut for technical component services. They are applying they're increasing the discount that applies to additional diagnostic testing services when additional testing services are performed on the same patient the same day. So you have CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis on the same patient, the subsequent procedure, the first procedure, highest paid procedure is paid at 100%, and the subsequent procedures are paid at 75% of the Medicare physician fee schedule. Both the House and the Senate bill have increased the discount factor, would increase the discount factor to 50%. Now, the House Reconciliation Act increases the utilization rate to 75% effective 2011. This bill actually dovetails with the final rule that CMS adopted under the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule. It applies to expensive technology, the so-called expensive technology, that equipment that's valued over $1 million. By the way, the industry obviously has a great deal of consternation about this because there are many CT scanners, MR scanners, whose price does not exceed $1 million, and there's a great deal of concern. I don't know whether there will ever even be any litigation over this issue, but CT and MR scanners do not necessarily all price at over $1 million, but nevertheless, CMS is applying their rule to MR and CT services. But note, this applies to just those technical component services that were part of the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule 2010 rule. So this utilization rate would be effective January 3, that's the first business day of 2011, January 3, 2011. And it would also increase the technical component discount for multiple imaging procedures from 25 to 50%.
The Senate bill also included a stark provision that affects imaging in the physician office context. It adds a requirement to the stark in office exception that's right now explicitly applicable to self-referrals within the office for MR, CT, and PET. But the secretary can designate other designated health services. And the precise requirement in the law is that at the time of the referral, the practice must inform the patient that they can get this scan somewhere else and give the patient a list of alternative suppliers in the area where the patient resides. Interestingly, they go to lengths to use the term supplier and use the defined term supplier, which happens to explicitly exclude hospitals, which seems a bit odd that they would not have wanted that list to include any hospital outpatient department alternatives in the patient's area, geographic area, but that's literally what it did. They might, you know, massage that in the rulemaking. It's literally effective January 1, 2010, but wouldn't expect enforcement of that until probably a final rule on its issue. Let's jump topics here to Medicare coverage of diagnostic techs. Just a little bit for the beginners, basics, and then an important new development in the area of physician supervision of HOPD diagnostics. To be covered, a test has to be proven to be clinically effective. It can't be considered investigational or experimental. It's only covered if it's ordered by a physician or a non-physician practitioner working within the scope of his or her license. And using the results of the test in the diagnosis and treatment of the patient pursuant to a consultation or other encounter with the patient. So lastly, the test has to be provided by a facility that's properly enrolled in the Medicare program. It's a long list of potential suppliers, but the biggies for us as a practical matter are the solo physician offices, the physician group practices, the IDTFs, and the hospitals. You've got to have an appropriate level of physician supervision. It's going to be either general, direct, or personal. And how do you know? Well,
Except for Medicare inpatients.
Yeah, thank you.
Right.
There's a list of the work RVU file. Physician fee schedule work RVU file, and we've given you the link here, has a column, I think it's column AF, that gives you a number, 1, 2, 3, or other numbers. They'll tell you code to the level that's required. As a general matter, in my experience, MR and CT with contrast requires direct supervision. Ultrasound, X-ray only requires general supervision.
MR without contrast, CT without contrast would be general.
General supervision is required for all diagnostic tests. That's a minimum floor requirement, and that's simply having a physician that's responsible for the training, credentialing, competency of the techs, the proper calibration of the equipment, in other words, the quality of the technical component testing that's being performed. When a test requires direct supervision, however, which is, as I said, applicable only to a subset of all of the diagnostic tests that are out there, the standard is that a physician must be in the same office suite immediately available to assess, to assist and direct. They don't need to be in the same room. Important for you to keep in mind that unlike therapeutic services in the hospital outpatient department context, for example, physician supervision must be furnished by a physician, cannot be furnished by a non-physician practitioner, even if that would be within the scope of his or her license. Turning to the hospital outpatient department context and the as you know, the controversial physician supervision issue that has come up the last couple of years, we're going to focus specifically on the supervision standard as applied to diagnostic services provided by a hospital outpatient department. And there, the physician supervision standard varies slightly based on location. We tried to break it down for you very clearly what the three different buckets are. It's going to vary based on whether it's in the hospital or an on-campus provider-based department. That's one standard. An off-campus provider-based department is another, and non-hospital site, slightly different standard. So starting with the context of a diagnostic test that's being performed in the hospital or on an on-campus provider-based department. Direct supervision means that the physician's present on the same campus. You notice before I said direct supervision required a physician to be in the same office suite. That is the standard that applies to IDTFs and physicians, other suppliers, but not in the HOPD context. Physician must be present on the same campus and immediately available to furnish assistance and direction throughout the performance of the procedure. And procedure is not defined narrowly. It's the entire service. Concurrent, and post. Does not require presence in the room, clearly. And what do we mean by, what did CMS mean by immediately available? Well, they deliberately elected to not provide us with a specific spatial or temporal standard. I understand that one Medicare contractor, administrative contractor, has taken the position that immediately available means that you would respond in the same length of time it would take to respond to a code on the hospital campus or a code in the hospital, which I think is probably a reasonable bright line that medical director is providing, but I haven't heard that in other jurisdictions. The other bucket is off-campus provider-based departments. So you've got an imaging center that you're treating as hospital-based, but it's off the campus of the hospital, meaning it's more than 250 yards from the main inpatient buildings. There, the standard is different. The physician has to be in the off-campus provider-based department of the hospital, has to be in that physical space, immediately available to furnish assistance and direction. Of course, now you don't have to be present in the room, but this has, in my experience, raised the problem of when your hospital has a multi-site of service building where they've got a building off campus that is has an image, by way of example, an imaging center on the first floor in the east wing, and then has in the west wing some cardiologists, and was hoping that their cardiologists that are in a physician office, it's not hospital-based physician practice. These physicians are in a physician office, that they could be the supervising physicians. But during the day, when they're in their offices, they will not be in the provider-based department, even though they might be across the hall. They won't be in the department. Took this up with CMS to see if they really meant this to be that limiting, and they told me in no uncertain terms that yes, they did.
Do you mind, Daniel, I just make one comment about that? This particular requirement dealing with off-campus provider-based departments is really not a new requirement. It was not new with the 2010 HOPPS rule, because it actually was adopted early on with the provider-based rules. It was added to 410.28 in about 2000 or 2001 to require off-campus provider-based entities to be subject to the same levels of supervision required for under the Medicare physician fee schedule test. I guess.
And then the last.
Maybe just one other comment I think is important about the HOPD is that unlike the therapeutic services, CMS has not imposed a credentialing requirement on who can supervise those tests. Any physician who has medical staff privileges in the hospital can supervise those tests.
In the off-campus provider-based department, direct supervision means that the physician must be present. See, we've gone back a slide. There we go. I'm sorry, in the non-hospital, our last bucket here, the non-hospital location. What do we mean by that? That's when a hospital sends a patient out to not one of its own departments, but to a mobile or a fixed-site diagnostic testing facility, let's say a mobile IDTF or a fixed-site IDTF in the market, to get the service under arrangements with that provider. There, the physician, we're back to the traditional historic standard of physician present in the office suite immediately available to direct and assist. Qualifications of the physician. This is, as Tom alluded to, this has become a hot area, getting asked a lot of questions about it. It's a controversial area, because CMS seemed to indicate that they expected these physicians that were supervising to be able to literally perform the service, be able to step in and do it. It almost seemed like they expected, I mean, not seemed like, it was as if they expected the radiologist, somebody to be able to step in and do what the technologist does. They certainly have to be able to be competent enough to provide assistance and direction. I mean, that's the literal language of the rule, that they have to be able to assist and direct. CMS, when asked, you know, pressed on this, said, well, we at least want them to be knowledgeable about the test. When I pressed them informally on what they expect and mean, trying to find some kind of bright line for our clients, seemed to defer to medical staff credentialing and privileging. And I know that it seems strange to submit to your medical staff credentialing process the notion of let's privilege people for supervision. I don't think it's necessarily, though, a crazy idea, because I think it would truly create a very strong shield against any allegation that you'd failed the assistance and direction standard. I think the threshold question that nobody seems to be talking about in the literature anyway is, you know, what do we mean by supervision? What is the clinical substance of the supervision? I think that's a clinical question personally, and I think it's one that's appropriate to defer to the medical staff on. You know, is it to deal with an allergic reaction to contrast in the case of MRI and CT? Or do they mean the person needs to be qualified to literally tell the technologist which buttons to push where, when, and how, and how to, you know, literally calibrate equipment or do things that the technologist has the training and experience to do? So I think that, you know, nobody knows for sure. I like to think they're telling me they're not trying to practice medicine, and they'll defer to the medical staff's determination. And I can imagine hospitals and risk management departments being reluctant to expand privileges to just supervision, but I think that it makes some sense. You know, if the medical staff has decided that the substance of the supervision, let's say in an MR with contrast, is an allergic reaction, an emergency, then it would be perfectly appropriate to designate an ER doc that's there at 3 in the morning to be the supervising physician for the test, it seems to me. But this is an area we could spend a good 10 minutes on this, but we've got to press on.
I think that's excellent advice. Actually, I tell my clients and I tell radiologists when I speak to them, I'd much rather have an emergency physician respond to my adverse reaction than they. All right. We are turning now to another hot topic, and that is the fact that in the Medicare Improvements and Patient Providers Act of 2008, you remember this is the bill that contained the SGR fix back in 2008 that President Bush vetoed and both the House and the Senate overrode. In MIPA, one of the features of that legislation, kudos to the American College of Radiology for pursuing this, there was a requirement that all non-hospital providers of advanced imaging services, those are defined as, remember my mentioning earlier, MR, CT, nuclear medicine services, including PET, all of those non-hospital suppliers of those advanced imaging services will be required to be accredited through an accrediting organization selected by CMS, designated by CMS to accredit those organizations, and must be accredited by January 2012 in order to be able to perform and be paid for those services under the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule. CMS has selected the accrediting bodies. In January, they published their notice of their decision with respect to who those accrediting bodies are. They picked two organizations that have a long history in terms of accrediting advanced imaging services with very thorough programs dealing with accreditation program, including things like looking at clinical images, having physicists review images that have been imaged against a phantom, a great deal of experience, and they, that, which those two organizations are the American College of Radiology and the Inter-Society Commission on Accreditation. They also selected the Joint Commission. And the Joint Commission selection is very controversial in the industry because the Joint Commission, while it does accredit facilities that do perform imaging, obviously it accredits hospitals, it has no history of accrediting advanced imaging services. It has not, to my mind, actually indicated that it intends to apply the same rigorous kind of accreditation requirements that are these other two organizations will apply. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. You know, the Act, MIPA, and the regulations adopted by CMS require the accrediting bodies to apply very significant credentialing requirements for the non-physician personnel, the radiologic technologists, and the qualifications of the medical directors and supervising physicians. The Joint Commission has never had a history of actually requiring those kinds of specific details. They're more focused on processes dealing with quality improvement. So yet again, I guess it's going to be a very interesting to see how the Joint Commission applies the MIPA requirements and those regulations that were promulgated to implement those that accreditation requirement.
Jumping to another hot issue, dual enrollment of an IDT, a multi-specialty practice, for example, and an IDTF. First of all, I think a threshold issue is when does a physician practice, for example, a radiology practice or just a garden variety multi-specialty group practice, need to enroll as an IDTF? It pains me to no end, and I try not to whine about it year after year, that CMS refuses to provide a bright line on this. There was at one time a fairly clear instruction in the manual on it, which was then pulled from the manual. Now you'll find from carrier to carrier local coverage determination, LCDs for IDTFs that will discuss when a diagnostic testing supplier presumably a physician practice, needs to also separately enroll in the Medicare program as an IDTF. I think in the last year, Tom, you had an experience where CMS is continuing to articulate the old standards that they had in the manual provision, which was with respect to a garden variety practice. The question was whether a significant portion of their testing was for outside patients. And I think the bright line we were using was 30% because that's what they had used in the laboratory area for when a physician practice needed to separately enroll its lab. And then they had a separate, more flexible rule for radiology practices that they just simply needed to provide most of their interpretations on site and most of the time bill globally. A very reasonable position on their part. Now you've got this confusion going on from carrier to carrier. So I can only suggest that you look for the LCD. If you want the old standard, I'm almost sure Tom has it at his fingertips. Happy to email it to you.
Yes.
If you want to throw that out to the carrier and use it. But that's unfortunately that's what you're going to have to deal with.
CMS has actually intervened in a number of circumstances involving client issues to actually advise the carrier, at least with respect to the issue Daniel mentioned, as to whether radiology groups or radiology hospital joint ventured imaging centers are required to enroll as IDTFs. They have actually consistently said that is their policy, so long as they follow the criteria that Daniel described very briefly, those entities need not enroll as independent diagnostic testing facilities. I am informed that CMS is actually developing some new guidelines. I guess we'll see in the manual at some point soon. You know, in CMS parlance, I guess that could be hopefully sometime in 2010. We'll see some further guidance.
Yeah, I know in my experience in Florida, the carrier there has articulated a rule that would require radiology practices to become IDTFs. And in Florida, it gets confused because they don't have a corporate practice of medicine prohibition. So you have ownership structures that look a lot like a lay-owned IDTF, but they've just contracted with some radiologists.
But I can tell you that some radiologists. Even within my own client base, we have converted what were IDTFs to radiology practice status, particularly as we move to the roll-up of the space-sharing prohibition that Daniel's slide mentions here for IDTF, so that those IDTFs that actually were sharing space with other enrolled entities beginning January of 2009, actually, were able to change their status to that of a radiology practice, a radiology clinic, and not have to maintain their IDTF status and run afoul of those requirements that were promulgated as part of 41033.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that strategic approach, other than I think that there are facts where it's the bona fides are lacking, that it's not, it's a gaming of the system that I think can be unsupportable at times when you don't have specifically when you don't have radiologist ownership of the facility. I think there are arguments there should be some exposure. But be that as it may, you could either try to turn your IDTF into a radiology practice, turn your group practice into a radiology practice so you don't have to deal with any of the sharing stuff we're now going to talk about. Because the IDTF sharing prohibition, is an IDTF standard. So if, as Tom's alluding to, you can be a radiology practice instead of an IDTF, you can avoid all this. But what if your carrier, and for whatever reason, you're just going to end up having to be an IDTF, and you're up against the space sharing prohibition? They've gone so far in the preamble language to say that they do expect the practice's IDTF site to have a separate suite number. They can share waiting room, common areas, parking, but they do expect this kind of physical separation. I think it's preposterous. They never did it for laboratories when practices separately enrolled as laboratories. I think it's preposterous, and it puts you through all kinds of contortions, but for now that's the standard. The good thing is that if you have questions about whether you're actually you have enough separation, the IDTF will have a site survey, so you can have the surveyor come in and you can say, look, here's how we've done it, here's how we've done it. But of course, if you're going to spend a lot of money on build out, you're going to want to have consulted with them before you spend all that money.
All right, to just follow up on our agenda here, we're going to talk a little bit about a very important emerging topic, and that is how technical component and professional component imaging services are billed. And this is actually playing out significantly with respect to the anti-markup rule and the place of service, date of service transmittal that many of you heard about and I'll be talking about. Daniel, in his early on definitional overview, talked about global billing and separate billing or itemized billing. Basically, global billing, as Daniel had indicated, is appropriate when there is performance and billing by the same supplier, generally performed by the same physician. You know, the technical component service is performed when a physician supervises the service. This is actually really an emerging area. The industry is not widely following this right now, but it's actually moving in this direction. The physician who actually performed the supervision should be the physician whose NPI is on that 1500 claim form. You know, Daniel described general supervision as being the supervision provided by the physician who has overall control and direction of the facility. There's only one physician who provides that general supervision. In fact, in with respect to IDTFs, because CMS believes general supervision is so important, they limit any one physician to performing general supervision to no more than three IDTF sites. That physician who performs general supervision services for every procedure that requires general supervision, whether it's ultrasound, plain film, MR, CT without supervision, that physician's NPI should actually, in terms of actually this movement toward total transparency and accuracy in billing for these services, that physician's NPI should be on that claim. And if a different physician performs the interpretation service, that should not be billed globally. And I have to tell you, candidly, that's not the way the industry has operated with respect to providing these services. But that's what I think CMS is actually trying to get us to move toward this idea of actually having itemized billing, identifying with the TC modifier, the NPI, that physician who actually supervised the technical component, and identifying with the 26 modifier, whether it's a separate line bill, separate lines on the same 1500 claim form, or separate claims themselves, separate 1500s, the NPI of the physician who actually interprets the service. Global billing actually is appropriate only when the same physician actually supervised the test and performed the interpretation. That is not the way the industry has provided those services. Generally, you'll find that the supervision services are not separately identified, and typically you'll find the industry bills for the service globally under the NPI of the interpreting physician. In fact, some physician practices may bill globally under the NPI of the physician who supervised the test. The way this is actually plays out in billing practices of physician practices and IDTFs is it varies widely. Yes, sir, you had a question, just briefly.
Yes. Is there a manual provision that says that global billing can be done only when supervising and interpreting the physician on the same person?
Yes, they're actually in the new anti-markup test transmittal that I'll describe in a moment. CMS indicated it is not appropriate to bill globally when there was a different physician who performed the technical service from the physician who performed the interpretation service. It's in the anti-markup test transmittal that I'll cite in a moment. So as I mentioned, actually on the 1500 claim form, the doctor who actually provides that service actually attests to the fact that they actually are the physician who provided the service. So here, where a physician actually serves as the medical director for a facility, an IDTF, for example, those claims for general supervision services should bear the NPI of the physician who provided the general supervision services. As I said, this is an area where the industry and CMS are moving toward more accuracy, more transparency with respect to how services are performed and billed under the Medicare program. Some very controversial CMS transmittals that have emerged over the last year, and I'm going to describe some of them for you very briefly. In the fall, CMS issued a transmittal, and this has actually been discussed in some of the other sessions here, a transmittal that would require careful transparency and accuracy with respect to the date of service and the place of service for billing for technical component services and professional component interpretation services. This transmittal that is cited here was initially going to go into effect on January 4 of this year. It was delayed till April, and then subsequently it has been rescinded, and there's ongoing discussion between CMS and the industry. In fact, there's going to be an industry meeting with CMS next week on the place of service, date of service issue. CMS actually here in this transmittal actually believes, and I think rightly so, although they never really articulated their position as clearly as they did in this transmittal, they are not changing their policy. What they're basically saying is that you should be applying, you that are billing for these technical component or professional component services, you should be providing the place of service code for where the service was actually performed. Not very difficult with respect to the technical component service. You've got a hospital inpatient service that bears a place of service code 21. But because of the technology that exists, particularly in imaging these days, physicians can be in the hospital, they can be in their home, they can be in a workstation in their office across town, they can be at another hospital. And if they are required to place a place of service code for their home, for example, if they have a home office, CMS suggested in the transmittal that that home office where the physician interpreted that study, even though it was a Medicare inpatient 21 where the service was performed, if that physician interpreted that service in his home and it was his home office, that would bear a place of service of an 11. Otherwise, if it's basically his home office and in his home and it's not his office, that would bear a place of service code of 99. This also deals with the date of service as well. If the service was performed today, March 25, the technical component, but not interpreted until tomorrow morning, March 26, has a different date of service. Now, the industry is very concerned because their billing software is not adapted to this, cannot really deal with this issue because they typically bill for the place of service where the technical component service is provided. Place of service and date of service where the technical component service was provided. It was a Medicare inpatient, 21, the place of service, Medicare inpatient, 21, regardless of where it was interpreted. But we're moving toward this area of, as I said, transparency and accuracy with respect to how these services are billed. This area cuts across a lot of areas, not just testing services. CMS issued a transmittal. I think many of you are probably aware of this transmittal that actually would effectively require, although the language of the transmittal does not say so, that for all ordering and referring providers, suppliers, physicians who order procedures, DME, diagnostic test, as a result of this transmittal, that that the Medicare administrative contractors are instructed to look for their NPI in PCOS. If they're not in PCOS, they are instructed to look to their master file to see if they are actually enrolled and have an NPI. If they're not in PCOS or in their master file, the claim is to be denied. This transmittal was initially going to be effective January 4, 2010. A lot of discussion with the industry. It's been delayed till January 3, 2011. There's a lot of discussion, obviously, efforts, I guess, on the part of CMS and the Medicare Administrative Contractors to get physicians in PCOS. The challenge with this particular instruction, this particular manual provision, is that those who don't enroll in PCOS are not penalized. Those who are performing the referred service are those that are penalized. When the Medicare contractors were sending remittances to those that were performing diagnostic tests in the fall, when they were moving from the phase one of this transmittal to the phase two section of the transmittal, many providers of diagnostic imaging services were getting as much as 30% to 40% rejections for those claims because those physicians were not in PCOS. This would be widely detrimental to the industry if that would be the impact when this goes into effect in January 2011. And as I mentioned, there have been a number of transmittals to manualize the anti-markup rule. Daniel and I have had a lot of discussion about this particular transmittal. It was issued in January, and this is that right? Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, yeah. In the last couple of months, it was issued in January. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And mostly this transmittal is very straightforward. It this and some subsequent transmittals that were issued within the last 2 weeks are basically manualizing the anti-market rule. But what CMS has done with respect to manualizing the anti-markup rule is they have basically removed from the manual all references to the former terminology that had in the past been formerly known as a purchase diagnostic test, that's the technical component, and they've also removed what were formerly called purchased interpretations. Now, the purchase test portion, the technical component, actually translates very well in terms of the changes that were made under the anti-markup rule because that dealt with markup issues. The purchase interpretation concept under the rule was a completely different concept. That related to a situation where a provider of technical component services received an order from a physician who did not have a financial interest or employment or any other kind of ownership or any kind of relationship with the entity that received that physician's referral for the technical component service. That entity performed the technical component service and had the test interpreted by a physician who also was independent of that facility. Generally, that related primarily to independent diagnostic testing facilities that had contractor relationships with radiologists who performed the supervision, but most importantly for this, the interpretation services for those IDTFs. Those IDTFs could actually, under this purchased interpretation exception to the reassignment rules, could bill globally for those services without reassignment, and were permitted to bill for those services for those contractor physicians to their local Medicare administrative contractor, regardless of the location for where the service was performed. I mentioned earlier that obviously imaging is an electronically driven specialty. Radiology is electronic driven specialty, and there are many teleradiology companies, for example, that are in the industry that have that provide services with radiologists who may, with that teleradiology company that may have a contract to provide interpretation services to an IDTF. That teleradiology provider may have radiologists in 5, 10, 20 states. If that IDTF is going to receive services from those radiologists who are in those 5, 10, or 15 states, under the rules that have been in effect, the manual instructions that have been in effect since January 2005, those IDTFs could bill their local Medicare carrier, their local Medicare administrative contractor, for those services for the physicians who are in states A, B, C, D, ad infinitum, without having to bill those services as reassigned claims. Those were purchased interpretations, met that criteria I described. Those were purchased interpretations, and they could be billed to their local administrative carrier, local administrative contractor. The local administrative contractor had received a zip code designation for a proper geographic practice cost index to apply to that payment. So the payment was paid appropriately with the appropriate zip code. You have a IDTF that's located here in Maryland. The interpretation service was performed in Florida. The Maryland IDTF billed the service to the Maryland carrier. Maryland contractor did not have to enroll in Florida for that interpretation service performed in Florida. And CMS has scrapped purchased interpretations. So what does that mean? That means that that local IDTF that has contracted with a teleradiology company that has radiologists who are providing their interpretation services from 5, 10, 15 states, if that now is a reassigned claim. It is not subject to the purchase interpretation exception to the Medicare reassignment rules. And that reassigned claim has to be billed to the carrier, to the Medicare administrative contractor. They now do it under the Medicare Claims Processing Manual, Chapter 10, Medicare Claims Processing Manual, Chapter 10, Section 10.1.1. Medicare Claims Processing Manual, Chapter 10, Section 10.1.1. Those services are now reassigned services and must be billed to the Medicare administrative contractor that has jurisdiction over where that service was provided. This zip code billing process that went into effect in 2005 went into the manual because IDTFs in particular were being challenged by the requirements previously that they had to enroll in these other states. This Maryland IDTF tries to enroll with a Medicare contractor in Florida, and Florida says, why are you enrolling here? You do not have a practice location here. We reject your 855. We're back to, we've really gone backwards with respect to this issue. And really, in my view, expressing my own personal opinion here, all interpretation services, all reassigned interpretation services should be capable of being billed because of the technology, should be capable of being billed to the local Medicare administrative contractor, whether it's a radiology group billing for the service, hospital-based radiology group, physician practice. IDTF should be capable of being billed because they actually have the technology to be capable of being billed to the local carrier. Do we have time for a question, Daniel? Do you want to keep moving? I apologize. We need to move.
Anti-markup rule. We can't do a diagnostic session without at least spending a little bit of time on the anti-markup rule because it has so much to do with how you're going to structure any kind of ambulatory arrangement with referring physicians. The rule is quite simple on its face. A supplier, example, a physician, but not just a physician, cannot mark up to Medicare the net charge for a diagnostic test ordered by the supplier. This is key, ordered by that same supplier. So this doesn't apply at all to the IDTF with no physician ownership or physician practice or other arrangement where there's no physician. We're not talking about tests being ordered by the supplier or physician practice itself. So this is why it primarily relates to physician practices, because there you're going to have the self-referral. Ordered by the supplier unless the test is performed. Now, performed is Tom's already talked about, a test is performed, in the case of the professional component, by the interpreting physician. The technical component is performed by the physician who's providing the supervision. And those physicians have to be a part of the billing supplier's entity, part of that supplier, part of that medical practice, in order to avoid the anti-markup limitation. So how do you demonstrate that that interpreting physician or supervising physician is part of your, I'll just say medical practice, because that's going to be the most common situation? You've got two alternative tests that CMS has given us. Call them the substantially all and the same building test. Substantially all test requires that the performing physician perform at least 75% of his or her professional services through the billing physician or supplier. There's an exception for, you know, locum tenens filling in for that regular performing or supervising physician, but otherwise they have to be at least a 0.75 or 75% of their patient care time has to be provided through this practice, whether they're a contractor or an employee. So you can see by that standard that this is not going to be something available to the smaller group practices, for example, that are not going to have enough volume to hire somebody 0.75 to do their interpretations or their supervision. But it is a suitable alternative for the larger, very large multi-site practices that have the kind of volume to support hiring somebody to provide their supervision or their interpretations in the case of the professional component. The same building test, the other test, which is more suitable for the smaller practices, is that the ordering physician, notice our focus is turned from this physician who's interpreting or performing the test to the ordering physician. The ordering physician has to furnish substantially the full range, not a quantum of services. Now it's about the range of services that they provide in the same building where the test is performed. Query whether a GI who spends a lot of time in the endo lab provides substantially the full range of his or her patient care services in the medical office when they spend so much time down the street at the ASC is a conundrum I've run into. But in any event, that's the standard. So, you know, where is the test performed? That begs the question, well, where is this test performed? Because that's where our ordering physician has to provide the full range of their services if we're going to avoid this anti-markup limitation. Well, with respect to the interpretation, it's where it's read, which, as Tom has alluded to, could be, you know, the office, home office of a radiologist, or it could be, with respect to the technical component, it's two things, and this creates a conundrum. Where it's conducted, where the tech is actually, you know, pushing the buttons, but also where it's supervised. Supervision does not always require a physician to be in the same building. General supervision only doesn't have any spatial, you know, requirements. So you could have your supervising physician in another building. Does that mean that the ordering physician has to provide the full range of their patient care services in both the building where the tech is and the building where the supervising physician might be? I don't know quite how to resolve that one. If neither test is met, you're limited to the lower of actual charges, fee schedule, or net charges, and CMS has defined net charges in a way that really squeezes you. If you're performing physicians and an employee or a contractor, net charge is limited to an allocated portion of their salary or their compensation, and you cannot build into that any overhead expense whatsoever. So you're definitely going to take a hit if you just cave and subject your business line, your service line, to the anti-markup limitation. If you do buy it from a truly independent third party, just up and buy your interpretation from another company, not an independent contractor physician that you've made direct arrangements with, but with a completely independent company for your technical component or your interpretations, there it's just whatever you pay them is what you're going to be able to charge Medicare. So the takeaways, just briefly on this, are that you've got two alternative tests to try to avoid it. You can use one test for the professional component and a different one for the technical component. The substantially all test is your best one for a good one for very large group practices that have that kind of volume, but the same building test is really the only practical alternative for your smaller group practices. And lastly, wow, Tom, we did it. we will have time for that question. Just one last slide. Two notable recent developments, in addition to the healthcare reform bill development we touched on at the beginning of the presentation, you've got underarrangement transactions continue to plague our practices, as I'm sure you're aware of. You know, what does it mean for these companies to perform radiology and other diagnostic testing services, which would make them a DHS entity under the rule changes in October 2009. So it continues to be a controversial issue. CMS in the 2010 fee schedule asked for comments on whether it should provide a definition of what it means to perform the services, and asks the industry to provide it with any and all inculpatory information about how they are still doing underarrangements. CMS basically says, and let us know, you know, how are you doing your underarrangements deal now after we did the rule change? We'd like to know. So feel free to tell them how you're doing them. MedPAC also is in the news with their considerations in recent meetings and reports of considering whether to recommend a rule change to CMS to address physician office-based utilization of expensive of DHS. Interesting topic that could warrant some considerable amount of time, but just keep in mind that there is on the horizon some I would say some likely tinkering. I mean, that's my crystal ball gazing. I think there's going to be some tinkering within office, probably with extensive grandfathering of existing expensive arrangements. And I think they'll, if they're doing it in a principled way, they should include radiation. They'll probably include radiation therapy in that consideration as well, because a lot of radiation therapy is being done on a physician office basis as well, which would seem to raise the same issues as expensive MRI and CT.
This issue of what is meant under the definition of perform, what is meant by the question of performance is obviously going to be a much anticipated rulemaking by CMS if they actually decide to issue rules, because when they publish that rule in the IPPS standard and subsequently they always decline to describe what performance means. Bottom line, the way actually many of us look at that is performance for purposes of this new definition of entity under Stark, performance meant performing the full array of that service. For diagnostic testing services, that would generally mean the equipment, the non-physician personnel, and the physician component, the physician supervision. And then particularly a significant piece of that was missing, and the physician investor was had an investment in an entity that contracted to provide equipment and a tech, for example, or just equipment, does that mean performance? The CMS at the time, they changed the definition of entity, changed the definition of the requirements for equipment lease arrangements, as you know, to no longer permit a per-click arrangement to be considered to be set in advance, fair market value arrangement, and requires aggregate arrangements. So this is going to be a much anticipated piece of rulemaking from CMS. We do have time for that question.
We have 2 minutes.
Absolutely, Drew, that had to be licensed. Yes, sir.
In the lower unit, or can they get somewhere
Well, the threshold issue they face is the fact that the location test of the in-office exception to STAR requires that it be inside the building.
Oh, radiology group.
Yeah. Well, then Yeah, I think that's a great question. It comes up in the hospital outpatient department context as well, too, because what does it mean if it's under arrangements with the mobile IDTF? They have that same standard of being in the office suite. What does it mean to be in the office suite when you got a mobile unit? I mean, is it enough that it's pulled up right against near the back door, do you have to have a tunnel between the mobile IDTF and the office to make it part of your suite? I mean, that's crazy. I mean, so yeah, I don't, you know,
these
I'm curious.
Gonna be, these
you,
are going to be you, very, very fact, if, very fact-driven considerations. And I guess the importance in terms of anything that requires direct supervision is that testing facility is going to have to demonstrate that they actually have taken steps to make sure that physician is as close by as feasible.
Yeah, but if it's a spatial standard in the office suite, yeah. I don't think you can just say, I don't know literally if you can just say, well, we were close enough. There's a spatial standard in the office suite.
Right.
So, I mean, you could have you gone to a carrier about a mobile in that situation?
We've talked to carrier medical directors, and they tend to at least understanding about these situations, but there are no rules, there are no guidelines. The only thing we have is the definition that's at 42 CFR 410.32B. Those definitions, they're there, and it require, and the language is exactly as you describe. Back in the back. Well, the rule at 414.50 makes reference to the ordering physician, the service being billed by the ordering physician's practice or that supplier entity, or by an entity that is a related organization by purposes of ownership or control. And I guess the real question is whether or not under the cross-reference to 413.17, whether that ordering physician is one who is under the control of the billing provider. And it's really not clear in the CMS CMS preamble comments when they promulgated the anti-markup rule whether that physician who's part of that hospital, maybe an employed physician, should he have control of the related entity, the hospital to bill for the service, or is he under the control of his employer, the related entity? But I think if it's just a member of the medical staff who has no financial relationship with the hospital, I would not see that triggering the anti-markup rule.
All right.
I think that response is probably not very clear. I apologize.
No. Yeah, come on up afterwards, folks. If you'd like, leave us with your card. We can get you some things or some items. They'll be posted on the website. Thanks a lot.